Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston at NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Yesterday's conflict does not have to be tomorrow's war. President Donald Trump uttered those words earlier today after meeting face-to-face with the North Korea dictator Kim Jong-un.
Our unprecedented meeting, the first between an American president and a leader of North Korea, proves that real change is indeed possible.
It was a surreal tableau, the stars and stripes nestled against North Korea's own flags of red, white, and blue. Months ago, Trump had called Kim Rocket Man for his nuclear threats. Kim had mocked Trump as a dotard. Today, the two men showered each other in praise and signed a joint agreement. Kim pledged his country to denuclearization. Trump swore off military exercises in the Korean Peninsula. It is a moment of hope that lacks any clarity. There are precious few details. This hour on Point, what to make of the summit with North Korea. You can join us on air or online. Did Trump's seat-of-the-pants approach pay off? Can the U.S. trust Kim Jong-un to keep his promises? Join us anytime on onpointradio.org or on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Singapore via Skype is Jonathan Cheng. He's the sole bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal. You can link to his most recent story headlined Trump-Kim Talks Short on New Nuclear Pledges from North Korea at our website, onpointradio.org. Jonathan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you do us a favor, sketch the scene for us? You were there. You saw this play out in front of your eyes. What was it like to see President Donald Trump and the North Korean authoritarian leader meeting, greeting, taking part in these talks?
Well, the first thing I should do, I should clarify that I wasn't right there. It's a relatively small hotel. I was there just a few days earlier, but I wasn't a part of the press pool that was there. But I was in the press center watching it all take place. And of course, we've witnessed a number of summits recently with Kim Jong-un and the rest of, his neighbors and their leaders, with Moon Jae-in of South Korea, with Xi Jinping of China. But Donald Trump and the U.S. presidency more generally is a different ball game altogether. You're right to point to the flags sitting next to one another and just how unusual it was to see a scene like that. And put on top of that, not that this was the biggest disparity by any measure, but the age gap between the two of them and just exactly how far they've come rhetorically from where they were just a couple of months ago. It was stunning.
You saw this play out in a single day. As you think about the amount of work that's to be done, how remarkable is that?
I think it is quite remarkable. And keeping in mind, too, that I don't remember how long it was, but maybe 3 weeks ago, maybe we didn't even know what city this was going to be held in. And it wasn't any of the two countries that are involved. So it was quite a big operation. Singapore is a great place to host it in a certain sense, and that they're a very efficient city and that they don't have to worry too much about some of the other things that other potential host cities might have to worry about. Like security is much easier here because protesting is not really allowed, and you have a relatively small city-state to manage.
There's a moment I saw on TV last night where Trump and Kim seemed to head towards the beast, as the president's enormous armed limousine is called informally. The door was opened. He waved toward it, and then they walked off. What was happening there? Were we ever able to find out what kind of personal rapport the two were building?
No, we weren't able to find out definitively either way. Our guess, just watching it, it seemed like Trump was offering Kim a ride, but we really don't know. And I was hoping that it might come up in the Q&A. Trump spoke for more than an hour to reporters, but the question never came up. So perhaps it'll come out in the coming days. But for now, we really don't know.
President Trump talked about his desire to get to know the North Korean leader. Here's what he said about how he prepared ahead of the North Korean summit as he spoke last Thursday at the White House.
I think I'm very well prepared. I don't think I have to prepare very much. It's about attitude. It's about willingness to get things done.
What were the expectations coming into to the summit that's played out over the past 24 hours? What did people expect, Jonathan Chang, as they set to record this historic moment?
Well, I think there was definitely going to be an emphasis on how the two personalities would get along, precisely because there hadn't been much preparation done in advance. So much of it was riding on just how these two men would get along. And for the most part, it does seem like they did strike up some sort of a friendship is probably too strong of a word, but they really seemed to enjoy each other's company a little bit. You know, I mean, they were touchy. They were putting their hand on each other's backs. They were, as you said, offering perhaps a ride in the beast. And if you listen to the words that Donald Trump had for Kim Jong-un afterwards, he said, "We had a terrific day and we learned a lot about each other. I learned he's a very talented man. I also learned that he loves his country very much." These are the kind of words that you don't expect to hear from a U.S. president speaking about someone like Kim Jong-un with the human rights record that he has. But again, I mean, this was really the kind of summit that was going to ride on personalities. And by that measure, it looks like it was at least not a disaster.
You refer to the human rights record, and we'll make sure to touch on that a couple of times this hour. Nonetheless, it's worth, you know, reiterating, underscoring, you know, a place of extraordinary human rights abuses and violations in that country. It's really its history over the past, call it six decades. Kim Jong-un himself made some remarks through an interpreter at the document signing with President Trump earlier today. It was interesting to hear what he had to say.
"We had a historic meeting and decided to leave the past behind, and we are about to sign a historic document. The world will see a major change."
That was Kim Jong-un speaking through an interpreter at that document signing. Jonathan Chang, what did we learn, if anything, about Kim himself, about his nature, about his personality?
Well, we saw more of what we saw during summit meetings with Moon Jae-in of South Korea. He is young. He is relatively untested. Up until a few months ago, he had been in power for more than 6 years, but hadn't met a foreign head of state, mm-hmm. hadn't left the country, as far as we know. I mean, he studied in Switzerland when he was younger, but as far as we know, ever since he took over from his father, he hadn't left the country. So there were questions about whether or not he really could be comfortable on the world stage. But here he is, treating himself and believing himself to be an equal, not only of Moon Jae-in, not only of Xi Jinping in China, but of the leader of the free world. He didn't bat an eye. He didn't blink. He didn't seem like he was the lesser party here. He really acted as if he belonged there. And if you just dial it back 12 hours before he met Donald Trump, he went on what was actually quite an extraordinary night tour of Singapore. And it wasn't quite impromptu. We know that his defense minister basically went out and did some reconnaissance mm-hmm. the day before. But from everything that we could tell, this was more or less a spur of the moment decision. Maybe this that afternoon he said, "I want to go and see the sights," and he did that. And he was, you know, charming the crowds, as it were, and he was in a selfie with the foreign minister of Singapore.
So getting something himself out of it by being on the world scene and being seen as himself, something of a magnetic presence. Jonathan Chang from Singapore. Jonathan is Seoul bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Of course. My pleasure.
We'll be taking some of your calls in just a few minutes, but joining me now from Washington is Anthony Ruggiero. He's senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy's think tank. He tracks policy regarding North Korea. I wanted to bring him in. He was official at the State Department from 2001 to 2013. During that time, he led talks with North Korea for the Bush administration, and the Trump administration used his research to help prepare for this summit. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us today on Point.
Thanks for having me.
What did you see as somebody who's thought hard about these issues, as somebody who's prepared hard for events like what we've seen play out this week? What do you take away from what played out in recent hours?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little bit surprised. I think, I think the focus on the optics really hides a wide gap on substance. It's clear that the sides are very far apart on denuclearization. You know, notwithstanding this statement or declaration, it's clear that one side, the U.S., wants complete, verifiable, irreversible destruction of North Korea's nuclear facilities, and the other side wants that North Korea just simply wants to commit to it. Unfortunately, you know, this new statement overnight is very similar to the 2005 joint statement, which I was a member of the delegation there. And the denuclearization clauses and security assurances are either the same level as 2005 or slight walkbacks from 2005. And I'm concerned about, you know, stopping the military exercises and essentially halting sanctions for little to nothing in return from North Korea. So, you know, the president says we're going to have this is a process and that the next step we'll get something more substantive. I certainly hope that that's the case. But, you know, as they say, hope is not a policy. So hopefully we have a plan for that.
Hope is not a policy. Briefly, is this how you felt after the 2005 conversations where a deal appeared to be reached along the same lines?
Yes. I mean, it's clear that North Korea has not yet, whether in 2005 or 1994 or in 2018, made a strategic decision to denuclearize. And if that's the key issue for the United States, we should be using all levers of American power to convince them that they should be doing that.
Anthony Ruggiero, I'd like you to stick around. You're with the Foundation of Defense of Democracies and been involved intricately in North Korean issues. We're, of course, discussing this week's historic North Korea summit, President Trump and the North Korean dictator that's just been held in Singapore. You can join our conversation. What does this agreement really mean? What does North Korea have to gain from the agreement? What does the United States? Where does the world stand after this rather vague but rather hopeful moment? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about President Trump's face-to-face meeting with Kim Jong-un of North Korea and what follows. Has the U.S.'s eagerness for a deal allowed North Korea to slip off the hook for human rights violations? What of the contrast between the meeting in Singapore and President Trump's remarks to allies in Canada? I'm speaking with Anthony Ruggiero. He's with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And joining us now from New York is Suzanne DiMaggio. She's senior fellow at the New America think tank. She focuses on U.S. foreign policy, the Middle East, and Asia. And last year, she helped to facilitate the first official talks between the Trump administration and North Korea. Suzanne, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
You know, I want to play for a moment what President Trump had to say at a news conference in Singapore after the summit. He said he'd like to withdraw troops from South Korea in the future.
We have right now 32,000 soldiers in South Korea, and I'd like to be able to bring them back home. But that's not part of the equation right now. At some point, I hope it will be, but not right now. We will be stopping the war games, which will save us a tremendous amount of money, unless and until we see that the future negotiation is not going along like it should.
Stopping the war games, stopping what are often called joint military exercises with South Korea. One of our listeners posts on Twitter that the person who deserves the most credit for all of this negotiating is Moon Jae-in. That, of course, is the South Korean leader. He never gave up on keeping diplomatic channels open. That said, the South Korean government seems to have responded tentatively in some ways to what President Trump first had to say in the wake of this summit and this agreement. How would you judge, Suzanne DiMaggio, what the reaction has been, particularly in the immediate countries surrounded and particularly in South Korea, the other country perhaps most affected by all this?
Well, I think generally the results that they see is that diplomacy is now underway, and that's a good thing. tensions have been dramatically reduced, and particularly for South Korea, this is important. The real question is this a start of a real process of negotiation? The statement that came out of the summit identifies the heart of the negotiation, a permanent peace on the peninsula in exchange for denuclearization. That's a good start, but it was a lot of spectacle and very little substance. And I also think from the South Koreans' point of view, my understanding is they were quite blindsided by President Trump's statement that we were ready to stop the joint military exercises with them. My understanding is that was a bit off the cuff, and it wasn't discussed prior to the announcement with our allies, the South Koreans. And this is a pattern that seems to be emerging in how President Trump treats our allies. Remember, when he canceled the summit abruptly, he didn't consult with President Moon either. He just did it. So I think for our allies, this is a wake-up call that they can't necessarily rely on President Trump to work with them on these important issues. And just coming from the G8 summit in Canada, I think these are concerns that are really magnified now.
You know, I want to go to – you mentioned Canada. On Sunday, President Trump's top economic aide, Larry Kudlow, was speaking to CNN's Jake Tapper. And Kudlow said that Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had weakened the United States' position in Singapore by speaking out against Trump in a press conference after the G7 summit. Here's what he had to say.
On the eve of this, he is not going to permit any show of weakness on the trip to negotiate with North Korea, nor should he.
So this was about North Korea?
Of course it was, in large part.
So absolutely. Because Trudeau said that as Trump was going to Singapore.
Well, you know, one thing leads to another.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They are all related.
They're all related. Suzanne DiMaggio, you know, it may seem obvious from your vantage point of people who work in this world, but a lot of people, I think, who support the president like the idea of him going mano a mano, of him being in the room where it happens and deciding to strike deals. Why does it matter what whether or not our allies are fully on board ahead of time rather than after the fact?
Well, it's clear Trump has no problem exerting American power in the way he sees fit. A lot of the times that is a bullying approach. But what he fails to understand, and this is a big concern, is that that very power comes in no small part from our strong network of allies, which has taken decades to build. So he doesn't seem to understand that the power is based in our alliances. That's very short-sighted. And I really think he came into Singapore in a very weakened position because of his behavior at the G7 and pulling out of that agreement. Kim Jong-un thought he was coming to Singapore to meet with the leader of the free world. And after that very dramatic photo that Angela Merkel's team posted, it didn't seem to be that was the case.
We have a note here from the Associated Press. It says that South Korean President Moon's office released a statement saying he told Trump the summit was a success that laid down, quote, a big framework, unquote, for peace in the Korean Peninsula and the world, and that Trump told Moon he was impressed by Kim's determination reflected by a decision to destroy a missile test site. I want to take a pair of calls. Folks are lining up to weigh in on this. First, I'd like to go to Sarah. She's calling from Manchester, Vermont. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi, David. Thank you. I have listened to a lot of the speeches and heard it, what everybody's had to say, including the president and Kim from Korea. And I think our president, Donald Trump, is doing a fabulous job. I think there's way too much negative criticism against him. I don't think people are listening to all his words and the implications that are there. This man obviously has nuclear weapons, and he's not afraid to use them. So you have to tread very lightly, which I believe our president is doing. The name calling is over and all that kind of stuff, and I think we're headed in the right direction. And sooner or later, Mr. Kim will show his true colors one way or the other, and I have complete faith that Mr. Trump will know exactly how to handle him.
Sarah, thank you so much for that. We're also, I'd like to hear from Bill. He's calling from Newton, Massachusetts.
Yes. Hi. Hello, David.
Hey, Bill.
Sadly, I have to disagree with your previous caller and agree to impart with your guests. It seems that the president is completely unaware of the history of that peninsula, the involvement with China and Russia, and our militarization. I think there are 8 or 9 countries that have substantial nuclear capacity and capabilities. And I think in negotiations, one must know the lay of the ground and also must understand that it's only with mutual realistic and honest respect that as a power, the great power of the free world, which we are fast losing that status, we really have no right to dictate what it is we want them to do. It's a country that is, I mean, I don't understand why we're all just, I just listened to a professor at MIT and saying that the agreement that we have proposed, it lacks any efficacy.
Let's turn to our own panel. Bill, thank you for that. A concern there. You know, we had heard from apparently the South Koreans that Trump had said he was impressed by Kim's determination to get rid of one of his nuclear sites. I recall when President Reagan was involved in his own negotiations, I believe it was after Reykjavik in the mid-80s, you know, he said, trust but verify. Anthony Ruggiero, what faith do you have that we're going to be able to hammer out details? We essentially have none at the moment, that we can verify that Kim will follow through on the promise that he has affirmed at this time?
Well, I mean, David, we know how this movie ends. We've seen it many times before. It's like a bad Hollywood remake with new actors. The way this movie ends is with North Korea making promises that they have no intention on delivering. And there is no indication that this time is different. In fact, it feels exactly the same. I mean, it feels like deja vu all over again. You know, the suggestion of the nuclear test site now, you know, we got reporting last week or the week before that outside experts and those inside the U.S. intelligence community say that it was superficial and could likely be reversed. And I'm sure the missile test site that the president spoke of, they have many missile test sites and engine test sites. I'm sure they're going to destroy one while they'll keep others. The problem here is we need an organized process of denuclearization and focus on the missile program and not just North Korea sort of throwing out, okay, we're going to destroy this site and then we're going to destroy that site. That's not going to work.
Anthony, how much do you think that Kim got from simply the very fact of the ceremony itself, of the summit, of the pageantry, of the images he can put on television, of his picture being beamed around the world side by side with the president of the United States? This was something obviously that he wanted. You know, people have been describing it as a concession in and of itself, sort of ahead of time by America, by the U.S. government. How true is that?
I mean, I look at it two ways. The first is a North Korean leader saying that they want to talk about denuclearization while the administration is pushing forward on maximum pressure. Certainly, Trump was in a bad position. He could either say yes, and then you get this result, or you say no, and the Chinese say, okay, well, you're never serious about the negotiations, so max pressure is gone anyway. So he had to say yes, I would say that. And I'm not sure, you know, I don't buy the whole, you know, this is a significant achievement for Kim. Sure, they'll use it for propaganda and all of that. But the North Koreans have been meeting with senior officials, including former presidents and a sitting Secretary of State for the last 18 plus years. So this is not a suggestion that we've never met with them and now we finally met with them. I'm more focused on the substance. I mean, the optics, I'm sure Kim will use in his propaganda, but that's not where we get to a solution on this issue.
Suzanne DiMaggio, you know, is there anything to be derived from our understanding of how the Trump administration, and particularly really we're talking about the president, looks at dealing with the world? Are there any through lines, any consistencies we can discern here?
Well, there's a lot of talk about what is the Trump doctrine. And I think based on what we've witnessed now just over this past week, but even going back to the NATO summit and so forth, you know, one could say it's bully allies and embrace adversaries. I think that's the way it's emerging. But on the other hand, I want to push back on this idea that this isn't something different. I think this top-down approach, leader to leader, is something we haven't seen before. And it's an interesting way to turn things on its head. I think we need to test it and see. I mean, Trump is starting from the proposition that he wants to change the nature of the relationship with North Korea first. Mm-hmm. We've never done that before. So we need to test it. The stage is set now. And if you look at the statement, it was very heavy on hyperbole, thin on substance.
Not entirely a surprise statement with this president, right? The hyperbole. But
exactly.
What does that do for diplomacy, hyperbole?
Well, it sets expectations very high. And also critics can, cast it aside. But the next weeks and months will be critical. We need an ace team in place. The North Koreans have a very experienced team. The woman who negotiated this statement has been my key interlocutor, so I've gotten to know her quite well. We need an equally seasoned, experienced team. They have been, some of them have been doing this for 25 years. And my sense is that their team outperformed our team. Pompeo is set to lead this. I think we need a senior envoy dedicated to just this, just North Korea. Pompeo's had two face-to-face meetings with Kim Jong-un. It doesn't seem like he was able to secure anything concrete. Mm-hmm. He's not an experienced diplomat. We need an experienced diplomat leading this effort.
Let's talk a little bit about President Trump's assessment for Kim Jong-un after their meeting in Singapore. Here was a sampling of his remarks about Kim just in recent hours.
He is very talented. Anybody that takes over a situation like he did at 26 years of age and is able to run it and run it tough. I don't say he was nice or I don't say anything about it. He ran it. Very few people at that age, you can take one out of 10,000 probably couldn't do it.
Trump also sat down with ABC's George Stephanopoulos. Stephanopoulos asked Trump how he could trust a leader who has a history of committing human rights abuses, including forced starvation, the assassination of members of his own family, and the running of a police state.
How do you trust a killer like that?
George, I'm given what I'm given, okay? I mean, this is what we have, and this is where we are, and I can only tell you from my experience, and I met him, I've spoken with him, and I've met him, and this was, as you know, started very early, and it's been very intense. I think that he really wants to do a great job for North Korea. I think he wants to denuke.
Obviously, you don't have a head-to-head talk about denuclearization with somebody with those stakes, with somebody that you're already close friends with. At the same time, what about that, Suzanne DiMaggio? What about the record of human rights abuses? What about the glossing over of this even as a concern for on the global stage? Does that matter?
I understand the need to prioritize denuclearization as our top ask at this summit. But it's unimaginable to me that an American president would meet with the leader of North Korea and not raise human rights, not as an action item on the agenda, but at least express our concerns with the situation in North Korea, which we know is terrible. So that is shocking to me that but at the same time, not shocking because this is Donald Trump. Let's be clear. I think Kim Jong-un sees an opportunity in President Trump because he knows human rights are not on the top of President Trump's agenda. He knows he's not going to get a lecture on that or democratization or anything like that. So in that sense, Kim Jong-un sees in Trump a potential partner in this that is not going to lecture on those issues. And I think that's a big relief to them. For us Americans who are watching from the distance here, it's appalling.
Just quickly, a couple of folks have posted online. Gregors on our website said, I think Asian allies will be concerned about the cessation of military exercises with South Korea and see that as the possibly the first step of U.S. disengagement from the region. NSTEF posts that Trump deserves condemnation for at once using the American flag as a backdrop for a photo op with a tyrant while criticizing NFL players who take a knee to advocate for racial justice at home, exercising their own free speech issues. I'd like Anthony Ruggiero, Suzanne DiMaggio, please both stand by. We're discussing the meeting in Singapore between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. Of North Korea. You can join the conversation. President Trump now says he wants a real deal with Iran. Is this a real deal? Do you agree with the president that this is a positive first step? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the promise and the pitfalls of President Trump's summit with the North Koreans' authoritarian leader. You can join the conversation. Can this unconventional approach yield tangible results? What does it suggest about American leadership in the Trump years? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Suzanne DiMaggio with New America Foundation and Anthony Ruggiero, senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. I'd like to start by taking calls from a couple of folks. BJ is calling from Newell, South Dakota. BJ, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. It's DJ.
I'm so sorry, DJ. I like the letter D. Go right ahead.
No problem. Well, I just wanted to say that in view of the horror that I have felt since Mr. Trump got elected president about what he might do or say as a diplomat abroad, his response to Kim Jong-un seems totally different than his bombastic America First rhetoric that he's used at home, and I'm pleased. And I'm just wondering if he's going to maintain this. I mean, was he coached? Is it one more steep learning curve that he's been engaged in? Is it deliberate, or was he simply responding to Kim Jong-un's own confidence and youth, you know, mm-hmm. in this summit? And well, I'd like to get your experts' opinions upon that.
Sure. Anthony Ruggiero, let's talk a little bit about that, about Trump's demeanor, about what he seemed, at least what he's conveyed and what you know from your behind-the-scenes work with the administration in terms of his approach with dealing with Kim. And perhaps draining some of the tension from the relationship that has characterized the U.S. Toward Korea for these North Korea for these many decades.
Right. I think, you know, one of the interesting things that came out of the George Stephanopoulos interview, I think it was right at the top, was that apparently President Trump had talked to Kim Jong-un on the phone and some of his perhaps even other North Korean officials. So, you know, the stories about lack of preparation and all of that that you heard in the run-up clearly was not the case. So there was a lot of preparation going on behind the scenes, which I certainly know to be true. You know, I think the question here is whether the administration can pivot the seemingly good optics toward something concrete. And that has always been the challenge with North Korea. It's that they are more than willing to put things on paper. They'll negotiate really tough to get their wording on the piece of paper. But when it comes down to saying, okay, we're going to have inspectors here, here, and here, or okay, you need to declare for us your entire nuclear program so we can verify it, those are always the toughest negotiations, and they break down. And so the question for me here is, you know, that I'm looking at is how does Secretary of State Pompeo get from this point, point A, to point D, which is something very substantive and tangible from the North Koreans, and better, you know, equally good negotiators have tried to do that and have unfortunately failed at it. And, you know, the playbook, that would be a new playbook for the U.S. side to get something like that from North Korea.
I'd like to go to a call from Bristol, Connecticut. I believe we have Bob on the line for us. Bob, what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, my first point is I think the whole propaganda war aspect is backwards. Kim, yeah, he might have gained credibility on the world stage, but the person who has won the propaganda war in the last month is Donald Trump. He spiked a deal that he said he didn't like, the deal with Iran. Mm-hmm. He angered the G7 people as he flew away from the G7 summit. He renounced the agreement. Then he flies to Singapore and he signs a very vague 2-page document saying this means the first step toward peace on the Korean subpeninsula. It's a great propaganda exercise at home. He looks tough, he looks strong, and then he looks magnanimous.
Thanks for that, Bob. Suzanne DiMaggio, what is Trump getting out of this? Is he scoring points at home by looking like a leader, by looking presidential?
Well, there's no question he's scoring points with his base. But for the caller, I would ask, with all that bombast and tough behavior, at the end of the day, what can you point to in a concrete way that he's delivered for us as a country? How has he actually advanced our interests in any concrete way? And I think you'd be hard to identify something specific. In fact, I think he's upended, the system of alliances that we've depended on for so long. And what I hear from our European allies when I meet them is Trump an aberration or is this a new normal? They want to know because they want to prepare and take a different path if this is a new normal. And on the Iran deal, I do think that I would hope after this summit, Secretary Pompeo and his team are realizing how difficult it is to negotiate with an adversary. They're very different cases. I've traveled to both Iran and North Korea and interact with officials from both countries. There are some similarities in how you approach an adversary. And I think I hope that this interaction with the North Koreans is a wake-up call for them that the Iran deal was actually a pretty good deal. A more common sense approach to blowing it up would have been fulfilling our commitments to it and building on it, using the leverage that we would get from that to address the other issues that worry us. So I think that, the idea that Trump pulled away from this Iran deal right before meeting Kim, the North Koreans took notice. In my conversations with them, they've raised it every single time. And it worries them whether or not Trump is reliable to see a deal through. It also worries them if they reach a deal with Trump, would the next administration adhere to that deal?
As a result of the pattern set or the precedent set by what happened in
Iran.
We have word of what the Senate Majority Leader, the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, senator from Kentucky, has to say. He says President Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un produced a major step toward peace, but also cautioned that if the North does not follow through with complete denuclearization, the U.S. and its allies must be prepared to restore the policy of maximum pressure. McConnell was referring to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's earlier statement that the U.S. goal remains complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization by North Korea. Now, both of you are serious people, thoughtful, intent, knowledgeable, hardworking. You know, you want to understand what's getting done and explain what's happening and perhaps propel that forward in what ways you think appropriate. On the other hand, I got to talk to you for a moment about the spectacle of all this. You know, I turned on the TV last night and we have the moment at which the former director of national intelligence for the United States of America, James Clapper, is on CNN and he talks about the unique insight of a particular observer of all this. That observer was Dennis Rodman, who had earlier gone to North Korea, I think on behalf of Vice, and in some ways helped to talk to this president about this. There is, to my mind, in some ways, if you pull apart from the geopolitical efforts of it, kind of a reality show feel to some of this, in which you have players involved and you have dynamics involved, like the dissing of the Prime Minister of Canada, our long time, one of our most solid allies for so many years. You have the drama, the early departure. You have the declarative statements. You have the insults hurled at a guy that he's now praising. How do you process seeing all this play out at the same time that, of course, it has such serious implications and such possible harbingers of hope? Anthony, why don't you weigh in first?
Yes, I mean, last night was wild on many for many reasons, not just because of the lack of sleep, but you know, watching the coverage you were suggesting, I think that was the point where I realized there wasn't much that was going to come out, and looked at doing other things. But yeah, I mean, I've worked on North Korea for a long time, and it's been a wild roller coaster ride just in the last couple of weeks. I mean, you know, I was talking to someone last week, and they were asking, "So what's going to happen with the summit?" And my response was, "A week ago, the summit was canceled." You know, I think with this
administration, it's kind of whiplash, right?
Yeah, it's definitely whiplash. Whiplash, tennis game, whatever you want to call it. I think it's not typical for North Korea policy. I think there's some advantage there, but you know, as an analyst and as someone who you know is concerned about these issues, I worry that, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the focus is on the optics. And, you know, I think it was pretty clear that both sides were telegraphing that there was a substantive problem. And I think that's probably why you got this, at best, vague statement. The one advantage I would say of this whole summit is that we don't have to hear that, that Dennis Rodman is the only person that's met with Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. Perhaps we can move on from that, I hope. So,
Suzanne DiMaggio, does the celebrity Nukes Apprentice season, does it advance the cause in some way?
You know, I actually thought Jim Clapper had a good point. There's so little information and concrete intelligence on Kim Jong-un. Mm-hmm. And human interaction is really the best way to retrieve that sort of information. And given Rodman's access to the marshal, as he calls him, I would think he would have some interesting things to relay. But this speaks to a broader issue. We need to, now that the summit's over, we should find ways to increase that human interaction. One thing we should consider is the establishment of a liaison diplomatic office in Pyongyang, where we send some foreign service officers to staff that and reciprocate by having a liaison office of North Korea and Washington. Another thing is to get inspectors on the ground as soon as possible to begin the verification process. This wasn't elaborated in the statement, but I think this is where the rubber's going to hit the road, and we'll know right away if the North Koreans are serious. Will they let the inspectors back in? And then, of course, hopefully this will open the way to more people-to-people exchanges in the areas of sports, which I know is near and dear to Mr. Rodman's heart, and, of course, in the area of arts and culture.
You know, I want to take a call now from Olympia, Washington. We have Jacob. Jacob is an English teacher, and he has some of that human contact to offer. Jacob, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I am an English teacher, and I work in North Korea. And a lot of
those are two sentences I didn't expect to hear today. But tell us how that plays out, and what do you see when you go?
Well, normally when I go, I don't get to meet a lot of people. I'm very secluded, teaching government officials our language. And, a lot of these guys, they're very hopeful for the future. They see the United States and North Korea being able to work together to fight against the terrorist state of Israel. Mm-hmm. And it's really promising. It's really amazing. And
against the terrorist state of Israel, I'm sure a position that a lot of Americans don't share, but that's something that's articulated there.
They do. They really do, actually.
Huh. Well, I can see why they might be, I guess, interested in hearing from you. Nonetheless, interesting to hear from a human contact, whatever the political stance is. There are, of course, human implications for people in North Korea who have been languishing under the dictatorial heel, effectively, of Kim Jong-un and his family's reign there. And yet there are human implications in other countries as well. We have a call from Sumter, South Carolina. Mutab, I believe it is. Please let us know what your thoughts are on what's playing out in the last day.
Hi, David. I'm Mahtab Farid. I'm an Iranian-American. And for the expert who said she was appalled to see how the North Korean leader was meeting with Donald Trump, I have to say I was equally appalled to see John Kerry meeting with the Iranian dictators who have no respect for human rights, and human rights was not an issue. And during President Obama's presidency, we dealt with Cuba, which is also a dictatorial regime. So I think we need to be consistent, and we never really pressed China on their violations of human rights. So this is something...
Yeah, I need to correct the caller. I never said I was appalled by any stretch of the imagination that Trump met with Kim Jong-un. I think it's a great idea. I endorsed the idea early on, and I've been working on helping to set up that interaction between the administration and the North Koreans. So obviously I'm on that side. What I said, if you listened more carefully, is that I was appalled that he didn't even raise human rights to the North Korean leader. Not necessarily putting on the agenda as an action item, but simply raising the concerns that American president would have for how the North Korean people are treated. Simply that.
Mutab, thanks for your call. Anthony Ruggiero, I'm going to give you the last word in the next, say, call it 40 seconds. Tell us what you think is most likely to play out over the course of the next, say, 18 months. Where are we going to stand? How hopeful are we going to feel then?
Yeah, I think in short order, we'll have senior level at the Secretary of State, Foreign Minister level, trying to get some concrete actions. I think we'll probably know in the next 3 to 6 months. If the North Koreans are not willing to do something concrete or different, then I think these talks will break down and we'll go back to maximum pressure and more missile and nuclear tests. But that might be the right direction if the North Koreans are not ready to denuclearize.
Suzanne DiMaggio, I'll give you 15 seconds. What do you think?
I think the first step is to codify the suspension in nuclear and missile testing that they have underway. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that this statement didn't do that. And then next, moving on to how to freeze the program, capping the number of warheads they have, freezing the production of missile fissile material. Uh-huh. That's the material used to make nuclear weapons. And again, getting the inspectors back in the country. That should be a priority for us.
Trust but verify. That's the voice of Suzanne DiMaggio. She's a senior fellow at the think tank New America. Suzanne, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Anthony Ruggiero is senior fellow at the think tank Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bowman. Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Jeremy Ulosa, James Gross, Grace Tatter, Gretchen Voss, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Caroline Anders. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up tomorrow, I will be owing each one of them an apology for the pronunciation. We'll also be dealing with the fate of the AT&T Time Warner deal that has been decided, and with it, a message sent to media moguls and beyond. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.